The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Reflecting back on Easter weekend, and then today is April Fool's Day. You're listening to The Common Good. Happy Monday, friends. Welcome to The Common Good here on AM 1160, Hope for Your Life. My name is Brian Fromm. So glad to have you with us on this April 1st. It's April Fool's Day. Hopefully that you are steering clear of the pranks. You are the prankster, not the prank-y. Is that even a word? The one for whom the pranks are towards. And we're glad to be together. It's April 1st. And of course, what happens in April here is that it is going to be cold. It is going to be rainy all week. My kids, they got their baseball and softball. And I don't think they're going to play all week. They're just going to have to get used to Midwest springtime, old March in like a line, out like a lamb. Not so much the case. You remember the beginning of March was so warm, and now we're leaving March and it is cold and rainy and wet, and but it'll turn. This is what happens here in the Chicagoland area. We hope that you had yourself a great weekend. A lot of kids still off of school today. I know my kids had spring break all last week, and because Easter landed at the end of spring break, they get off kind of Easter Monday and have today off. So one more day off for the kids. Hopefully you had a great week. I want to spend the beginning of our show, reflecting upon Easter. It just, we don't want to just, well, Easter Sunday's over, let's be done. But we want to reflect a little bit upon this important holiday that we just had, this important day. Hopefully you had a good time with family. You were able to hang out with, you know, have a brunch. Our family went to an Easter brunch with my side of the family. Then we went for another meal with my wife's side of the family to their house. And this is what happens. We eat. But a wonderful day at church. I hope that you had a great day at church. For me, this was an especially poignant day, as it was our last day as Four Corners Community Church, our last day in the warehouse there where we've been for 14 plus years. If you listen to this show, you know that we are merging with another church in town because, for many reasons, but one of them, we got to get out of our warehouse because the rent is just too high. And the way we're doing this is we're both shutting down our churches and literally becoming a new church. And so this was an emotional day, as it was the end of something, right? It was the close out. It was the finish. Our church surprised my wife and I. They gave us a gift. And I didn't see it coming. Not sure how they kept that a secret, but didn't see it coming. But just super thankful. But then on top of it, it was Easter. And so you got lots of people. Most churches were probably more full yesterday than normal. And put laser focus on the good news of the resurrection, right? Leading up, we wanted to talk about each day and Good Friday. We had a Good Friday service as well, and it's dark and you're focusing on the death of Jesus, the despair of Holy Saturday, where the disciples would have been like, what's going on? But then you get to the good news and just the excitement of Easter Sunday. And I know at our church, it was an opportunity, right? Every church does the resurrection, but what do you say about it? And I took my sermon to be very much on the idea of hope. We live in a world, unfortunately, where a lot of people don't feel hopeful. whether it be the politics, the wars, and the inflation, or now we're just a couple of years removed from a global pandemic. And we can struggle to find hope. And Easter is our opportunity to once again say our hope is found not just in Jesus, right? That's an absolutely true thing to say. It is found in Jesus. But be more specific. Our hope is found in the empty tomb. That because Jesus rose from the dead, because Jesus lived, died, and rose again, because the tomb was and is empty, we have hope. We have hope. And we can have that hope because of where, O death, is your victory, where, O death, is your sting. And because of that, we have hope. I said during my message yesterday that when somebody's hurting, one of the almost cruelest things that we can say to them is, don't worry, it'll be okay. We can't make that promise. We don't know that it will be okay. On this side of eternity, it may not be okay. In fact, on this side of eternity, it might get worse. Jesus was honest about that. He said, in this world, you will have trouble. And so on this side of eternity, it may very well get worse. But then, what is a word of hope that we can give to people? If it's not, it'll be okay. It'll all be all right. What is that word of hope? Well, that word of hope is, he is risen. It's those three words. He is risen. And because he is risen, death does not win, struggle does not win, disease does not win, despair, disenchantment, disappointment, use all the D words you want. Those are not ultimate. What becomes ultimate is the hope and the grace and the life that we have because the tomb was empty. And because the tomb was empty, we can endure. We can go on. What does 1 Corinthians 15 say? We have victory in the Lord Jesus Christ. Therefore, stand firm. Therefore, stand firm. Let nothing move you. Always give yourselves fully to the work of the Lord, because you know that your labor in the Lord is not in vain. What is our response to the resurrection, to the victory that comes in Jesus Christ? Stand firm. Be steadfast and immovable, I believe the ESV says. Be steadfast and immovable. Stand firm. Keep going. Have hope because of what Jesus has done. Friends, that's the good news of Easter weekend. It's fun, Easter bunnies and Easter eggs and brunches and family. All of it is wonderful and tiring. But in the end, we're reminded, and we're going to continue to do this today while talking about some other things, to be reminded of the hope that we have. Friends, your hope as a Christian, everything rises and falls with the resurrection. Paul says, without the resurrection, our faith is futile, and we are to be pitied if it did not happen. But because it happened, because that tomb was empty, everything changes. Everything changes. Even those things that were sorrowful and sad can bring us joy because the tomb was empty. So what is the word of hope this morning? What is the word of hope every morning? The word of hope is three words. He is risen. The tomb was and is and always will be empty. Friends, that's the good news of Easter that we can live in every single day. I do apologize. I'm a pastor who just had Easter Sunday yesterday. I'm starting to lose my voice, trying to get it back today. It's always tough to do a radio show the day after Easter because your voice is just kind of gone. Because what do we do on Easter? We sing loudly. We proclaim loudly. We preach loudly. Everything's with full energy. So voice is a little shot today, but we are powering through. Hope that you had a wonderful Easter. And Philip Yancey wrote over Christianity Day, kind of about the days after Jesus rose from the dead. What must those have been like? And what can we learn from them? I just want to read a little bit of what he said. He wrote, after about 6 weeks of such random sightings, the disciples gathered again, still unsure about the future. Would Jesus remain on earth after all? If not, what did he expect of them? In the first meeting with the disciples after the resurrection, he commissioned them in John 20, as the Father sent me, I am sending you. And at the ascension, he literally turned over the mission to the ragtag group that he was still hoping he would revive their faded dreams of glory. It's up to you now, he said in effect. Jesus says he had healed diseases, cast out demons, and brought comfort and solace to the poor, the oppressed, and the suffering, but only in one small corner of the Roman Empire. Now he was setting loose his followers to take the same message to Judea, Samaria, and the uttermost parts of the earth. Think about that. Let's pause there. By the time Jesus raises from the dead, it's still very localized. The message is still basically in Jerusalem and Galilee. It's the disciples who are being told, it's time to go. You're going to take it to the ends of the earth. Continuing, 2,000 years later, 3 billion people around the world identify as followers of Jesus. The message he brought has spread to Europe, Asia, and every other continent. The chance of that spread without the jolting event we celebrate as Easter is vanishingly small. Before his resurrection, Jesus' few followers were denying him and hiding from the temple police. Even afterwards, Thomas doubted until he saw proof in flesh and scars. But as they came to understand what had happened in the resurrection, the disciples were able to glimpse Jesus' cosmic view. At the end of that poignant Last Supper, Jesus prayed for all who would follow. My prayer is not for them alone. I pray also for those who will believe in me through their message, that all of them may be one, Father, just as you are in me and I am in you. May they also be in us so that the world may believe that you've sent me. Then the world will know that you sent me and you've loved them even as you have loved me. How are we doing, we followers of Jesus in the 21st century? We should be known, Yancey writes, for our unity and our confident hope, for we are not of the world any more than Jesus is of the world, as he prayed in John 17. If we truly believe that Jesus is risen and let that reality soak in, it should help calm fear and anxiety over such matters as the economy, elections, and global unrest. To the watching world, followers of Jesus should stand out as peacemakers, as, quote, bridge people committed to love, not despise or our opponents, even our enemies. Yancey concludes this way. A friend of mine was stopped dead in her tracks by a skeptic. After listening to her explain her faith, he said this, but you don't act like you believe Jesus is alive. I tried to turn the skeptic's accusation into a question. Do I act like Jesus is alive? It's a good question, one I must ask myself again every day. So we spent yesterday proclaiming the hope of Easter. We spent yesterday, he is risen. He is risen indeed. But Yancey posits a very challenging and interesting question. Do I act like Jesus is alive? Is my life different because Jesus is alive? Do those who are not followers of Jesus look at my life and go, yeah, something different? Do I have a peace that others do not have? Do I strive for a unity that others do not have? Do I view the worldly things differently than those who do not have Jesus? See, for the disciples post-resurrection with the coming of the Holy Spirit, they changed. They went into the world and took the gospel to Judea, Samaria to the ends of the earth. They were full of boldness. Their lives were marked by boldness where before they were scared. Things changed. Because the whole concept of Jesus saying to his disciples, it's up to you now, remains the case today. It's up to us now. We are to be the ones bringing unity, bringing peace, flipping the world upside down and loving the least of these. If we truly believe Jesus had risen, if that's truly a reality, it should calm fear and anxiety over the things around us. We should be the people of peace. As Heath describes, bridge people committed to love even our enemies. And I guess we do need to wrestle with that a little bit. Do we believe so deeply in the resurrection of Jesus? Do we believe so deeply that he is alive, that it seeps down into everything that we do and it affects how we live today? Because Jesus is alive, I'm a person of peace and at peace. Because the tomb is empty, I'm a bridge builder, loving those who the world does not love, praying for my enemies. Because the tomb is empty, I'm now a person of boldness, boldly proclaiming this good news of the gospel because it's so amazing. He is risen. Or is this something, as Yancey talks about at the end of the article, that is part of what we talk about? You know, we say we believe this, but we look no different than the world around us. We don't treat hardship. We don't approach hardship differently. We don't approach our enemies differently. We don't look at the world differently. We don't have an eternal perspective. All of these things that we can now have because the tomb is empty. I think about when the women first get to the empty tomb and the angel's there, and he basically says, "What? Don't fear. Don't fear. He's not here. You have nothing to be afraid of." This can be a scary place, friends, but the fact that we are followers of Jesus needs to make a difference in our day-to-day lives, where we become then people of peace, people of unity, people of love, people who build bridges. And I do fear that that's not the church's reputation. So we turn it on that skeptic's question at the end. Do I act like Jesus is alive? Not was alive, is alive. Do I still act like that? And if not, then why not? It is April Fool's Day. Later on in the hour, I'm going to share some of the funniest April Fool's pranks, some of the biggest April Fool's pranks from across history. But hopefully you're not the butt of any April Fool's jokes today. It's also, as we said, April 1st. It's the beginning of the baseball season. And my team feels like they're already done. Got to be honest. It's been years since I've been less optimistic about my Mets. I'm a New York Mets fan, and they dropped 3 to the Brewers this weekend, and the games weren't even really very close. And I usually opening day, it at least gives you like a month of like, all right, I'm excited. I'm ready for this team to go. Obviously super long season to go, so it could get turned around, but not a great start for my Metsies against the Brewers at Citi Field in New York. Losing all 3 games, and that's what happens in baseball. I'll tell you what. All right, over at Religion News, we read this. New human flourishing, quote-unquote, human flourishing survey links frequent religious practice to life satisfaction. According to the research, attending a religious service frequently positively influences characteristics from happiness and ability to make social relationships to physical health. Let me read you some more of this. It's a Gallup research. According to the results of a new global flourishing study, a consortium of scholars and pollsters led by Gallup said they could find links between religiosity and people's satisfaction with their lives. The study, a joint project of Harvard and Baylor Universities, Gallup, and the Center for Open Science, aims to uncover what influences, quote, human flourishing, which is defined by measures of happiness, character, and virtue, and social relationships, among other values. According to the group's research, attending a religious service regularly positively affects flourishing. They said this. This is Byron Johnson, director of Baylor University's Institute for Studies of Religion, said this. We're not shocked at that because there's a lot of other research that indicates that faith is important to human flourishing. But it may come as a surprise to people that religion would be an important thing. Now, earlier studies have shown that religion could help young people struggling with mental health, but also that being involved in a congregation could influence the levels of happiness. This article is going to go on and tell us how they did the article. But reread this. Respondents who said, quote, religion is an important part of daily life score higher on average than those who didn't. Those who attend a religious service at least once a week scored even higher than those who never do. Attendance 1 to 3 times a month correlated with a higher score, but a few were not as high as those who went more regularly. The study also revealed the gaps in human flourishing scores are largest among people in Turkey, in the Philippines, and in Nigeria. In an article commenting on these results, Gallup also noted that context is important to understand the data, as other factors related to financial stability, such as being employed and living comfortably, also played a role. All right, so here's what we're finding. Amongst other things, religion and being a part of religious gatherings, it adds to human flourishing, to happiness, to contentment. And I would say those of us who are Christians would go, duh, of course it does. Of course it does. But what would the reasons be for this? Why would this be the case? Well, the first is, I think there's a sense of community in this, right? There's a communal nature when we gather, and that we can't undersell. This is why the book of Hebrews says, don't forsake the gathering. Don't give up gathering together. Don't stop gathering together. Why? Because it not only helps our faith, but it helps one another. The Bible, the New Testament, is full of one another's. We don't give up meeting together. Spur one another on to love and good deeds. Run the race together. We somehow in our individualistic society have set up our faith as being just me and Jesus. It's just us. When in reality, it's meant to be one another, together, communal, joined together. They didn't know any other way in the first century, but we do. We're more individualistic, but it's to our detriment. Think about what happened to our flourishing a lot during COVID when we weren't able to be together. So I think churches should lean into the community aspect of this. We should lean in to the communal aspect of our faith. We should gather together. We should encourage gathering together. We should look for ways outside of Sunday morning to gather together. But I also think there's a second reason, and it's a bigger reason. That's because religion, and those of us who are Christ followers would say that it's in Christianity, but religion at its core gives purpose. It gives meaning. And when we have what we feel like is purpose, a big purpose in our lives, then how to put this, we're going to flourish more because we don't feel like we're just hurtling through this or this life, living our days with no purpose until it ends. And then it ends and then there's nothing. But instead, as we have this interconnectedness with the generations, as we know that our life right now matters and that after this life, there is eternity to come, we take on a purpose. Think about your life when you feel a deep sense of purpose and meaning. And then think about your life when you don't have a deep sense of purpose and meaning. When it's just about you, when it's just, you wake up, what am I going to do today? But no, when your life is driven by purpose and meaning, it changes things. Well, what's the purpose and meaning? Love the Lord your God with all your heart, mind, and soul. Love your neighbor as yourself. Go and make disciples of all nations, baptizing them in the name of the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit, teaching them to obey everything I've commanded you. And surely I'm with you always. You're Christ's ambassadors. And as we embrace this large purpose that we have, as we embrace this purpose that we have, then we can live, we can flourish. It changes our lives when we have purpose. So I think it's the two things. I think it's community and I think it's purpose. And the church can offer these things. People in the world are wanting these things. People are constantly asking, what's the point? And especially in our day and age of isolationism, people are asking, where can I find real friends? Where can I find real meaningful connections and community? The answer to both of those, I believe, is in the church. And we as Christians need to proclaim this. Join us. Find purpose. Find community. Find what you're looking for. And that leads to human flourishing. Not surprising, but an interesting article that does point to some things that I think the Bible speaks very clearly about. But today is April the 1st. You know what April the 1st means. It's April Fool's Day. What do you think about April Fools? Are you a fan of the, we're going to prank people. We're going to do, it's fun. It's a good time. As long as it's not destructive or hurts people. I think it's fun to be able to laugh and to be able to do some fun stuff. But I found this article over at History. 7 incredible April Fool's Day pranks from history. Here are 7 rather elaborate pranks that have well and truly gone down in the historical hall of fame. Are you ready for these? These are awesome throughout history. Number one, the Great Spaghetti Harvest. In 1957, the BBC pulled off what still ranks as one of the most famous April Fool's Day gags of all time. 8 million people tuned in to watch Panorama's 3-minute feature on the, quote, Swiss spaghetti harvest. After an unseasonably warm winter brought an end to their dreadful spaghetti weevil pest control issue, the region of Ticino near the Italian border was said to have yielded an exceptionally heavy spaghetti crop. The footage showed people picking strands of spaghetti off trees and bushes before tucking into their homegrown feast. The prank occurred long before pasta became a staple in the average British diet, making the audience ripe for the picking. When viewers phoned in to find out how they could purchase their own spaghetti trees, the BBC told them, place a sprig of spaghetti in a tin of tomato sauce and hope for the best. So they got people convinced that they could grow their own spaghetti trees. That they could grow their own spaghetti trees. And that was how it ended up. Number two, of the 7 of the best pranks in history, the washing of the lions. It was in 1698 that people were first tricked into attending the washing of the lions at the Tower of London. That makes it one of the oldest known pranks in the historical record, and it would be repeated multiple times during the 18th and 19th centuries. One iteration occurred in 1848 when a journalist distributed cards inviting the public to the washing of the lions. As an onlooker wrote, I was not prepared for the extraordinary credulity of the British public. They flocked up in shoals to see lions washed. The warders were almost at their wits' end. They had the bits of pasteboard flourished on their face in their faces with angry gestures and angrier imprecations by the indignant crowd of sightseers and seekers. So they pretended that it was just the washing of the lions at the Tower of London, and everybody showed up I'll be honest, I'm not following that one very well, but sounds like it was hilarious. This one, 1980. Big Ben goes digital. In 1980, the BBC World Service announced that the world's most famous landmark was getting a facelift. The broadcaster told listeners that to help tourists tell the time, the Big Ben clock tower would be going digital and would henceforth be known as Digital Dave. The new and improved monument wouldn't just tell the time, it would also issue a 5-minute news bulletin every night. On top of that, the iconic bongs would be replaced with beeps. While some listeners clocked that this was an April Fool's jest, many others rang in to express their outrage. A BBC spokesperson commented, surprisingly, few people thought it was funny. I think the funniest part of that one is that they had renamed Big Ben Digital Dave. That's pretty funny. Number four, the incredible color television hack. In 1962, years before color television was rolled out in Sweden, viewers of this one particular television were tricked into believing they could transform their black and white screens with an easy do-it-yourself hack. Kjell Stensen, a quote, technical expert, went into intricate detail on how stretching a mesh sheet over their screens could bend the light's wavelengths, allowing viewers to view and see in full color. Luckily, this could be easily achieved with an item found in many homes, nylon stockings. As it was the only TV network in Sweden at the time, enjoying the trust of the population, thousands fell for it, and local stores quickly sold out of nylon stockings. So you've got all these people stretching stockings over their television, thinking it would then be in color. All right, number five of the seven best April Fool's pranks in history. The Jovian Plutonian effect. Renowned astronomer and beloved presenter of Sky at Night, Patrick Moore, had the credibility and stern air of authority, which allowed him to pull off a prank that was out of this world. In 1976, Moore told radio listeners that due to a rare planetary alignment of Pluto and Jupiter, the Earth would experience a shift in its gravitational forces that morning, allowing them to float into the air. At precisely 9:47 a.m., Moore instructed the listeners to jump now. Within minutes, calls were coming in reporting that they had felt the impact of the Jovian Plutonian effect. One caller claimed that she and her 11 friends had orbited gently around the room. Another complained that he had risen so high that he hit his head on the ceiling and he demanded compensation. These people called in saying it worked when it was clearly a joke. And then one of them wanted compensation. That's funny. By the way, I do remember once in my life, I think it was the fifth grade, my language arts teacher made us take a quiz, a vocabulary quiz, and it was really hard. And we were all like, oh, this is the worst. We all thought we were failing until everybody realized if you took the first letter of every word, it spelled out April Fools. So where am I? Number six, Edison's miraculous machine. In the year following his invention of the phonograph in 1877, the New York Graphic jumped on the opportunity to trick their readers into thinking Thomas Edison had created a new machine capable of turning dirt into meat and water into wine. Edison invents a machine that will feed the human race, ran the sensational headline. It was, of course, a total fabrication. The writer even admitted this at the end of the article, concluding that he woke up and it was all a dream. This didn't stop several American newspapers from reprinting the story, believing it to be true. In their next edition, the Graphic condemned the hasty reading by their gullible audience under the tongue-in-cheek caption, "They bite dirt into meat." That would be awesome. Last one. The volcanic eruption that wasn't. One of the most audacious pranks of all time was the fake eruption of the Mount Edgecumbe volcano in Alaska. It was carried out not by a media outlet, but by a local logger named Oliver Porky Bakar, and was a hoax years in the making. Bakar diligently collected 70 tires, which he stashed away in an airplane hangar, waiting for an April Fool's Day with a clear enough sky and the right weather conditions to pull off his plan. That came in 1974, when Bakar used a chartered helicopter to deposit the tires into the volcano's crater. He then doused them with fuel and set them all right, causing a satisfyingly thick and ominous plume of smoke to billow up. Local townsfolk rushed into the street, fearful that the long dormant volcano was going to blow. While the police and fire service were in on the joke, Picard had forgotten to inform the Coast Guard. They flew over to inspect the situation, but instead of seeing molten lava, they saw the old tires ablaze, surrounded by a giant spray-painted letters reading, "April Fools." Some great ones over the years. I wonder if any good ones will get pulled off today on this April Fool's Day. Hope that you're having a good one. So we're continuing to think about Easter, right? We're continuing to think about Easter. Yesterday was the day of celebration for all Christian traditions, right? Like, regardless of your denomination, size of church, whatever else, yesterday was the day of celebration where we proclaim he is risen. It is the foundation of our faith. Everything about our faith rests on the historicity, if you will, of the resurrection of Jesus Christ. Paul says, without the resurrection, our faith is futile. We are fools. We are to be pitied. And so, Brett McCracken over at the Gospel Coalition does ask an interesting question. Have we become numb to the resurrection shock and seemingly bored by history's biggest event? To ask it another way, why does the headline, "Billions Worship a Man Who Rose from the Dead and Ascended to Heaven," seem like old news that barely registers as a trending topic? This is one of the great dangers of our day, when the good news becomes old news, not bad news. It's not like we wake up one day and we go, "Oh, you know what? The good news of the gospel is now bad news." No. The danger for us as Christians, especially those of us who have been Christians for a long time, is that the good news of the gospel becomes old news. We become apathetic to it. We become used to it. And Brett here wants to ask about, on a bigger scale, why on a bigger scale, culturally, is this not huge news, right? Like, if this happened today, it would obviously dominate everything. If people claimed that the savior of the world, who that people just saw killed, rose from the dead, and there was some question about it, it would obviously be the trending topic of social media. It would be the breaking news of every cable news station. It would be all that we talk about. And so he asks, has this become old news to us now? And if so, why? And he gives some theories. He says, number one, it's old in a world obsessed with new. He says part of why the resurrection seems like old news is that it is old news, especially in a culture of increasingly short-term memory. Few of us can remember what was newsworthy a week ago, let alone a year or a century or two millennia ago. The digital age has eroded cultural memory and our capacity to think about now, beyond the now. According to algorithm and push notifications of our devices, what matters is what's happening now, not what happened or will happen. Digital capitalism is built around ephemeral consumerism, and technologies are formed to funnel our attention into present tense tasks, distractions, and attention-occupying experiences. The old news of Christ's resurrection doesn't serve the algorithm's interest. So the very fact that it happened over 2,000 years ago, it is old, is one reason. Number two, it's familiar in a world addicted to fresh. What's familiar tends to bore us. This is our nature going back to Eden. Rather than being content with the given, we're curious and hungry for the exotic, the unknown, the novel. This has never been more true than in our algorithmically structured world, where money is made as attention is held, and attention is held by a steady stream of novel amusements, hot takes, and wow, haven't seen that before twists. There's little currency in the familiar, which fails to engage audiences conditioned to swipe past what they've already read, watched, or listened to. That's why he says in many churches, especially contemporary churches, we try to do the new thing for Easter as opposed to just telling the story. Number three, it's fanciful in a world unsure of what's real. Reality feels elusive in a deep fake world. A hermeneutic of suspicion becomes a survival mechanism when everything feels tainted by bias or fodder or some tribe's conspiratorial narrative. We start to question anything with a whiff of fakery. Certainly an ancient cult that developed around a Jewish rabbi who claimed to be God and whose followers claimed to encounter his reanimated corpse checks that, quote, sounds unreal box for many. That doesn't mean it's not an appealing story, but many people doubt if it's a reality. That's why the resurrection of Christ feels less like shocking news than like a cultural artifact among many that might be adopted, rejected, appropriated, or integrated into a person's collage of expressive identity. These dynamics are at work not only in our hearts and minds of secular folks, but in believers as well. In a world like this, growing ever less enchanted by the wonder of Easter and ever more numb to its shocking truth, Christians have to fight not to follow suit. If we become bored by the annual declaration, "He is risen," what hope is there for non-believers to take interest? Christians should reclaim the shock, the awe, the world-altering, life-transforming, society-reshaping magnitude of Christ's resurrection. We should bodily rehearse it, not just as an aesthetically pleasing, family-friendly, feel-good holiday mood, but instead as the historical fact that it is. The orientation of our Easter practices has to go beyond brunch plans and what are you going to wear to church on Sunday? The Easter church gathering is one of shocking news, of a historical event. He ends this way. Think about the biggest world news events of recent generations. September 11th, JFK, D-Day. It's normal to mark anniversaries of these events, but usually annual commemorations die after a few generations, right? Our grandkids may not remember or notice or commemorate September 11th, or our great-grandkids. Yet Easter is an annual remembrance of a historical event that's still being celebrated, arguably on a greater scale than ever, nearly 2,000 years later. That's because it's the biggest news story of your life, or any life, even of those who shrug it off and scroll right past it. Friends, we can't lose the wonder of Easter. We cannot lose the awe of Easter. Our Savior was hung on a cross on Friday, but then the tomb was empty on Sunday. And because of that, everything changed. As Christians, we cannot allow the good news to become old news, to become white noise. But we must keep at the forefront of our mind, He is risen. And because He is risen, we have hope, we have grace, we have forgiveness, we have life. Death has been defeated, life has been bought. We have eternity with Him to look forward to. Everything has changed. See, one of the good news of Easter is that it's not about us. It's not about our righteousness. It's not about our self-righteousness. And that we can come to Jesus broken and hurting, needy. That's the message of Easter, that it's about what Jesus has done, not what we have done for Him. And in fact, throughout this, we see just people screwed up. Scott Sauls over at his blog, he writes about this in a Substack, a blog entitled "Coming to an Empty Tomb, Screwed Up, Broken, Clingy, and Scared. Easter Thoughts for Those Who Don't Have a Sunday Best in Their Repertoire." He wrote this on Easter. And he talks about his own struggle with gossip. And then I'm just going to read the last couple paragraphs of his writing as we kind of end today's show. I want to speak specifically to you who think you're not worthy, who struggle in that way. We read this. Anne Lamott once said that everyone is screwed up, broken, clingy, and scared, especially those who pretend to have it together. Like Peter, we're all duplicitous. We confidently proclaim him as Lord and pledge in full sincerity to never betray him. Then we somehow turn around and we do so like traitors. But then Jesus comes to us as he did to Peter, reaffirming his love, our status as his daughters and sons, and our usefulness as his servants. After failing and wanting to throw in the towel, I received the following affirmation from a friend, Sauls writes. Somehow he had gained access to a letter from a father to his self-doubting, struggling son, and he wanted me to have it. Here was the letter. Dear son, I continue to pray in the struggles you face. I've been so helped as I've thought about some of the following things. I don't want you to ever forget that Moses stuttered and David's armor didn't fit and John Mark was rejected by Paul and Hosea's wife was a prostitute and Amos's only training for being a prophet was a fig tree pruner. Jeremiah struggled with depression and Gideon and Thomas doubted and Jonah ran from God. Abraham failed miserably in lying and so did his child and grandchild. These are real people who had real failures and real struggles and real inadequacies and real inabilities and Jesus shook the earth with them. It's not so much from our strength that he draws, but from his invincible might. I am praying that he will give you courage and in this quality of his. I love you, Dad. Sauls goes on to write, whatever your story, whatever your regrets, I hope you too can be strengthened by these realities. That because Christ has died, Christ has risen, Christ will come again. Because Easter happened and is true, your worst moments and seasons do not define you. And they don't have to immobilize you. Right, being humbled into contrition and repentance by your own pornography of the mouth, he was talking about gossip earlier, or perhaps by some other setback or source of shame, might be the beginning of a new fruit-bearing season for you. Christ not only saves the worst of sinners, he also befriends and bolsters and deploys them. Ask Jesus to increase your self-awareness. The sin and corruption we carry is like the tip of an iceberg, so much more that we don't see floats beneath the surface. As Jack Miller famously said, we are worse than we think, but God's grace is also greater than we ever dreamed it could be. Romans 5, 20 and 21, where our sin abounds, grace abounds. God's grace super abounds, he writes. This is Christ's invitation to walk with a humble limp and loathe our prideful strut. There's no better time than Easter to stop thinking, speaking, and acting as if the biggest problem with the world is other people. There's no better time to befriend our mirrors and put away our microscopes. Let Christ befriend, bolster, and deploy you. Own the worst in you. Then wait in hope for him to resurrect the best in you. And say to your own heart what a caring friend has said to mine many times. God rolled away the stone on Easter, not to let Jesus out, but to let us in. Self-loathing, self-righteousness. I don't deserve this grace. That's what makes it grace, friends. That's what makes it grace. And we come to Jesus. We come to the cross. We come to the empty tomb, acknowledging that we are screwed up, broken, clingy, scared. Acknowledging these things about our lives. Not with some veneer, not with some fake mask that says, look at me, God, I'm worthy of you. No. We're worthy of God because of Jesus. Because Jesus came and lived and died and rose again, that makes us worthy of him. Not because of these other things, not because we think we have things to offer. This is the story of the prodigal son, the broken, lost younger son who has rejected his father, coming home and receiving forgiveness, while the older son who has never left but is prideful and self-righteous, not sure if he ends up back in the party. Don't be the older son, but be the younger son, falling at the feet of our Heavenly Father going, I don't deserve anything. I don't deserve anything good, but you have given it to me because of Jesus, because of Jesus, because of Jesus. That's our mantra. He is risen. He is risen. And this is good news. Friends, why do you believe that you've been justified before God? What justifies you before God? If it's anything in the first person, I, then you've got it wrong. But if it's he, now you understand. Now you get it. Now you're ready to embrace the amazing grace of the gospel of Jesus Christ. Coming to an empty tomb, he is risen, screwed up, broken, clingy, and scared. thankful for Scott Sauls, who's living much of this out right now, trying to figure life out. May our righteousness, our thankfulness always be rooted in the grace that God has shown us through the life, death, and resurrection of Jesus. May the words that give us hope not be, hey, I'm all good, but instead be, he is risen. Well, thanks for joining us today on this Monday after Easter. Glad that you are with us. Join us again tomorrow from 4 until 6 p.m. Until then, my name is Brian Fromm. So glad to have you with us today. You've been listening to The Common Good on AM 1160. Hope for your life.
3-star general Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.